copyright forum of Christian leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
I'm really looking forward to doing this session with you on how to avoid being an undercover Christian and addressing you. I recognize many of you are in Christian ministry or are evangelists or all that kind of stuff. This session particularly is really aimed at folks who have got none of those experiences. And I love teaching it to groups like yourselves, because my hope is that then you'll then go and teach it to others. Because I think the big challenge is how those of us who are naturally gifted at being evangelists and apologists and so forth, how do we replicate that to others? And so this session is really designed to be super accessible. And, you know, if there's stuff here that's helpful, feel free to go and teach it yourselves. You don't need to ask my permission to do any of that. But to kind of set the scene for where I want to go in this next 25 minutes or so, my first job was working in administration for the psychiatry department of a large teaching hospital in London. Any jokes about working with psychiatrists and mental health patients preparing you for dealing with crazy atheists would be entirely unfair. And I worked in that medical school for about 5 years, and I loved my time there in the 1990s. Had a huge lot of fun doing that. But one of the things that interested me, looking back on my time there, is I feel a little bit guilty in some ways, because during my time working in the secular kind of health sector back there in the 1990s, I was very much what you might call an undercover Christian. In fact, I've always thought undercover Christian would make a great title for a movie about Christians kind of sneaking around trying not to be identified as believers. And even though I was involved in lots of ministry, outside work and at church and so on and so forth, at work, I very much hid my faith away. And I wasn't alone in that, actually. I remember the week that I left that job after working at the hospital for 5 years, they threw a little kind of lunch reception for me on my last day. And I discovered at my leaving lunch that a colleague who worked just two doors down from me in our corridor, she was also a Christian, but she'd also been playing undercover Christian. And both of us had been so secretive about our faith that even though we worked together quite closely for 5 years, neither of us had discovered the other one was a Christian. And looking back now, I often find myself asking the question, what was it back then that I was afraid of? Where was the fear coming from? And I think if you'd asked the kind of 25-year-old me why I didn't share my faith publicly or identify as a Christian at work, I think the fears I would have identified are fears that I hear from lots of people when I teach on evangelism. You know, it's not uncommon for Christians to be afraid of sharing their faith in this very secular culture. And I think when you ask people why, and if you'd ask the 25-year-old me why, a few things get come up time and time again. There's the fear of looking foolish. I think that's a common one. Fear of looking stupid among our friends. One person put it to me, there's a fear of looking good, fear of making God look bad. I remember somebody once said to me in a seminar I taught, she came up to me and she said, I don't talk about my faith at work because I'm afraid I'll make the gospel look bad. It's probably better for the kingdom that I say nothing. Fear of standing out from the crowd is a big thing. Certainly in British culture, we don't like standing out from the crowd. And so I think a lot of Christians keep their faith to themselves. In the workplace, implications for our career. I think if you'd ask the 25-year-old me why I didn't share my faith, I think there's a sense of, gosh, if I get identified as a Christian, or, you know, or being awkward in some way, then, you know, that could affect my career prospects. And so you say nothing. And there's the fear of being asked a question we can't answer. I just caught the end of that brilliant session you've just had, and that really tough question you were looking at, the old violence in the Old Testament. I know many Christians are terrified of being asked questions like that, and so they say nothing. And so given our very secular culture, I think it's not surprising that many Christians are afraid and nervous about sharing their faith with their friends. And if we're ever nervous, how can we overcome that? But particularly as we teach others in our churches and in our home settings, how can we help them overcome this fear? Well, I live in Scotland, in the UK, where I head up an organization called the Solas Center for Public Christianity. And we've been here about 3.5 years. But before then, I lived in Toronto, in Canada. And shortly after we moved to Canada in 2010, I met a family doctor, a GP, called Peter, who was a lovely Christian man and soon became a good friend. And I remember a very early conversation with my friend Peter, in which he said these words. He said, "I love being a GP. I love being a family doctor because it gives so many fantastic opportunities for evangelism." And he went on to tell me how he'd led many, had the privilege of leading many patients to Christ right there in his consulting room. Now this, my ears pricked up, you know, GP, a doctor leading patients to Christ. How does that work? After all, I don't know about the countries that you're in, but here in the UK and where I was in Canada, I meet many Christian GPs and medics and other public service professionals who are terrified of talking about their faith at work for fear of getting fired. You know, you often hear stories in the headlines of some poor Christian nurse or medic, you know, who's offered to pray with somebody and suddenly all hell has broken loose and they've been fired. So when Peter said he was using his platform as a GP to share his faith, my ears pricked up. What was he doing? When I asked him, he kind of laughed at the question and he said, "It's really simple." He said, "When I meet a patient who is dealing, struggling with some kind of health issue or the such like," he says, "I like to ask them a series of questions. I take them on a kind of life audit." He would say to them, "Okay, tell me about your diet. Are you eating well? Tell me about your exercise regime. Are you exercising well?" And so on, half a dozen of those kind of questions. And then the last question he would throw into the mix is he would say to them, "Tell me about spirituality. Are you making space for that in your life?" And he said, invariably, they would say to him, "Doctor, what does that mean? What's spirituality?" And Peter would reply, "Well, you know, some people meditate and some people do yoga. I'm a Christian. So in my case, I read the Bible, go to church, those kind of things." And Peter went on to say that about 90% of cases, and he looked at me and said, "I'm a doctor. I'm good with numbers." It's about 90% of cases. People would then say to him, you go to church, doctor? You read the Bible? How does that work?" Well, of course, now they're asking him questions and he's much freer to talk about his faith because they're leading the conversation. And he'd been doing this when I met him for about 15 to 20 years and had seen about 100 or so patients over that time actually end up giving their lives to Christ through that conversation. And of course, the key to what Peter was doing in those conversations was simply asking good questions. And as some of you may be aware, questions are perhaps one of the most powerful evangelistic tools that we have available to us, yet they're also one of the most overlooked. When I teach seminars on evangelism in churches and introduce the idea that asking good questions is the key, you can see people being utterly surprised that something so simple and so much part of everyday life and everyday conversation could become a powerful evangelistic tool. And of course, the idea of using questions in evangelism is not some kind of modern technique. It comes from Jesus, who was the master question asker. And somebody once counted up the numbers, and I think it's something like 300 times in the Gospels that Jesus either asks a question or more commonly responds to a question with a question. Let me show you an example, and then I'll give you a contemporary application of how we could use this very same method that Jesus uses here in a real-world conversation. So Matthew chapter 22, we read this famous story where Matthew tells us that the Pharisees went out and laid plans to trap Jesus in his words. They sent their disciples to him along with the Herodians. "Teacher," they said, "we know that you are a man of truth, man of integrity, and that you teach the way of God in accordance with the truth. You aren't swayed by others because you pay no attention to who they are. Tell us then, what is your opinion? Is it right to pay the imperial tax to Caesar or not?" Now, you probably know the context. We'll just pause here in the text for a moment. You probably know the context, many of you. First century Israel was an occupied land, and the Roman armies were considered by most pious Jews to be evil, occupying oppressors. And so if you paid your tax, you were considered to be collaborating with the enemy. On the other hand, if you didn't pay your tax, that was considered an act of rebellion, and it could lead to arrest and execution. So the Pharisees probably think this is an utterly brilliant trap they have sprung on this rebellious rabbi from Galilee. Now, how does Jesus answer? Every time I read this passage, I find myself thinking, "Lord, could you simply not have said, 'No, thou shalt not pay tax'?" Can you imagine how brilliant that would be? Every time that tax season comes around, April the 4th here in the UK, whatever it is in your part of the world, we could write back to the government as Christians and say, "We'd love you to keep our taxes, but unfortunately, Jesus said no." And I'm sure our governments would refund us with a big fat check. But of course, if Jesus had said, "No, don't pay your tax," he'd have been arrested instantly, If he'd said, yeah, absolutely, pay your tax, pay the Romans, he would have lost all authority in the eyes of the crowd and be morally compromised. And this is the thing. This question, of course, is not about economic policy. The Pharisees are not interested in Jesus' views of economics. They are trying to trap him. This question is actually about compromise. When is it okay to compromise morally is sort of one way of paraphrasing what they're asking. So in that light, Jesus' answer, as we read on, is brilliant. Jesus, knowing their evil intent, said, "You hypocrites, why are you trying to trap me? Show me the coin used for paying the tax." They brought him a denarius, and he asked them, "Whose image is this? And whose inscription?" Two innocent-looking little questions. "Whose image? Whose inscription?" "Caesar's," they replied. "Well then," he said to them, "give back to Caesar what is Caesar's, and give to God what is God's." Do you know, with those two little questions about a coin, Jesus redefines the entire conversation in such a way that allows him to say, yeah, you can pay taxes when they're appropriate, but that's not the real issue. The real issue is what we give to God. Now, I often wonder what would have happened if one of the crowds had sort of raised a hand and in the Q&A had said, well, you know, Jesus, what belongs to God? I wonder if Jesus might have looked at them and said, asked another question, whose image is on you? Just a thought. But look, using a question like this to clarify an issue has lots of contemporary applications for evangelism in the modern secular world. Consider this scenario. Let's imagine that you're sitting drinking coffee in Starbucks. Lockdown is finished. You're drinking coffee in Starbucks or another coffee chain. Other coffee chains are available. And you're having coffee with an old friend, old school friend. Maybe you haven't seen them for 15 or 20 years. And chatting away, you're having a lovely time catching up. And suddenly your friend looks at you and rather too loudly for your comfort says to you, hey, you're still into that Christianity thing, aren't you? Tell me, what do you think? Is abortion wrong? And then they ask the question so loudly that you can hear the sound of every other conversation in the coffee shop dying away as people stop their conversations and lean in to listen to yours. Your heart is going 120 beats a minute. The adrenaline is in the red zone. And you're thinking to yourself, what on earth do I say? Because, of course, the simplistic answer to that question, is abortion wrong, from Christian ethics, is to go, yes, it's wrong. But if you simply say, yes, it's wrong, loudly and clearly and in 140 characters or less suitable for Twitter, you know, what's your friend going to think? Is your friend going to think, my word, this is the wisest, the most informed, the most reflective, the most engaged, the most progressive answer I've ever heard? Pray tell me, from where did you get this ancient wisdom so I too can drink from the fountain of knowledge? The fact that you're all smirking, I can see that even in your little thumbnails, tells me that you know that's not the case, because in the eyes of our non-Christian friends, this issue is about a whole range of other things. And the words probably going through your friend's mind are words like narrow-minded, bigot, intolerant, and so on and so forth. Because, of course, in the eyes of our friends who are not Christians, this issue is about choice. And what do we call people who restrict other people's choice? We have adjectives for them, and they're not particularly charming ones. We use words like fascist or oppressor or dictator. And so here's a thought. If answering the question you've been asked is going to give the wrong impression of God and the wrong impression of you and the wrong impression of the gospel, maybe there's something wrong with the question. And maybe we should do the Jesus idea and redefine the conversation. See, for the Christian, this issue is all about life. So what about if instead you answered with a question? What if you said to your friend, when is it right? Before I answer your question, thank you for asking me a brilliant question, but before I answer it, let me ask you one. When is it okay to take an innocent person's life? Now, unless you're having coffee with a psychopath, in which case just leave the coffee shop quickly and smoothly, don't go near the cutlery drawer, your friend is probably going to say it's never okay to take an innocent person's life. To which you can say, brilliant, I completely agree with you. Now we can talk about the really important question here. What is in the womb? Is it just a random collection of atoms and cells, in which case, why are we even asking this the question? Or is it an innocent life? In which case, as you've just said, we need to realize we can't just take an innocent life, not without there being consequences. Now that question you've asked there doesn't guarantee at the end of the conversation your friend will have a weeping repentance on the floor. But it does set up, I suggest, the chance that this will be a more substantive and friendly and engaging conversation that might end on the gospel. Because otherwise, people don't hear sanctity of life, they hear restriction of choice. And asking questions can help clarify the real issue. And in fact, as somebody once remarked, the right answer to the wrong question is always unhelpful. Well, questions can be very powerful. And in my remaining kind of 13 minutes or so, I want to share with you three powerful little questions that you can use and teach to others as a kind of evangelistic toolkit. I've been involved in public evangelism kind of ministry for 15 years or so more now, and I've used these questions for years, and they serve you well in all kinds of conversations and circumstances. Let me talk you through them and show how they work, the first two at least with a scenario, and then say a bit more about the third, and then we'll draw it together. So this first question, you can learn to ask people in evangelistic conversations, what do you mean by that? Just helps kind of clarify what's going on. Let's imagine the scenario. Let's imagine you're in the workplace and you're working away at your desk and you're minding your own business when a colleague walks past you and they see the big black Bible that you have on your desk, because every Christian working in a secular workplace has the biggest, blackest leather Bible they can find on their desk, right? So they can identify themselves. And your colleague in passing looks at that Bible and says, oh, you're not into that religion thing, are you? Only idiots believe in God. There is no evidence that God exists. Science has disproven God entirely. And they say this so loudly that other people in the office heard, and you can see colleagues looking up from their work with a kind of this should be interesting look on their faces. One or two colleagues are even getting buckets of popcorn out from under their desk. This is Christians versus Lions round two. So how do you respond? Well, what if rather than hide in embarrassment or say something equally rude back, or, you know, reach for the fire alarm and pull it so everyone's dismissed? What about if you use the what do you mean by that question? For example, you might say to your friend, what do you mean when you say only idiots believe in God? I mean, after all, some of the world's greatest thinkers have believed in God. What is it particularly about belief in God that you think is stupid? You might say to your friend, you said there's no evidence that God exists. What do you mean by that word evidence? What would count as evidence for you? What would I need to show you for you to be persuaded that maybe there was something in this God thing after all? And you might also say, look, you use the word God a couple of times. What do you mean by that word? What kind of God don't you believe in? You know, Richard Dawkins, the famous atheist, says he doesn't believe in a psychopathic sort of fairy who lives in the sky throwing lightning bolts at people. Well, that's great. You and I don't believe in that kind of God either. What does your friend have in their mind when they use the word God? And any of those approaches might open up a conversation that actually leads somewhere rather than an argument or an atheist, you know, flinging a zinger and the Christian hiding under the table. So that's the first question. What do you mean by that? Second question in our little toolkit works similarly. So let's rerun the scenario from before, but just tweak it slightly. This time is your colleague walks past your desk in the office and sees your big black leather-bound Bible. You're also wearing your hat that says, I'm a Christian, please ask me any questions, like all Christians do in secular workplaces. This time their sneering remark is, nobody believes in the Bible anymore. You know, it's a ridiculous book riddled with contradictions. Oh, and to up the temperature here, this is not just any colleague. This time it's a senior manager. So not merely have you now got to think about how to respond, but if you get a bit too clever, you might be in all kinds of trouble. So how do we respond? Well, this is where this second question rides to the rescue. What if you looked at your colleague and said, well, thank you for that really good question, but if I may I ask one in return? What evidence has led you to that conclusion? In other words, what is it that you've read or seen or studied that has led you to think what you've just said about the Bible? I'd love to hear how you got to that conclusion. Or you might say, look, I've heard other people say similar things sometimes, that there are, you know, contradictions in the Bible. But I wonder, would you be able to give me an example of one of the problems that you've seen? I'd love to know some specific examples, because that might help me think about how I could respond to you. You know, either question done gently and in a friendly way just gently forces your colleague to actually justify what they've said rather than just make an assertion. And you haven't criticized, you haven't pushed back, you haven't even told them they're wrong, you've just asked a question. And from experience, one of two things will happen at this point. Either they'll say, well, everybody knows, which is shorthand for I have no idea, I read it on Twitter. Or they'll give you something specific, and then you can either address that directly, or you can say, that's a good question. You know, I don't know the answer to that, but I'll tell you what, if that really matters to you, I'll go and find the answer and come back to you. And either of those approaches can be really helpful. But there's one last question I want to talk about in our kind of last sort of 7 minutes before we go into discussion groups. And it rises out of an issue here. What happens if your friends, if your neighbors, if your colleagues, an example I've given, aren't flinging anti-Christian sound bites around the office? What if, you know, the secular friends in your life or the lives of those that you're teaching, what if they are just apathetic and agnostic? They just don't care about spiritual things. I once had somebody say to me, you know, I would love to have Richard Dawkins live next door to me because at least I'd have something to work with. But, you know, my neighbors and friends, they're just not interested spiritually. It's like starting conversations is like trying to nail scotch mist to the wall. Or this is where this third and final question can help you out. Have you ever wondered? And it's rooted in something that the Canadian philosopher Charles Taylor observed. Charles Taylor is a famous Canadian philosopher, and he wrote this big fat book called A Secular Age. And it is a big fat book. It is massive. You can use it for weightlifting after you've read it. And there's all kinds of good stuff in here. But one of the big takeaways in there is he argues that we've moved from a time when people were generally open to spiritual questions to now when people are closed. And as he describes the kind of traditional human view of reality, there was a big truth out there. And maybe there would be some way of sort of discerning what that was. And so people were open to religion and spirituality. But now, he says, we live in the world on the right of that slide where people believe there's a kind of ceiling. There is no such thing as a truth with capital T. In fact, feelings have replaced everything. And people live in this much more closed view of reality. But here's the key thing. On the one hand, that sounds quite depressing for evangelism. Were it not for the point he makes, and he's not alone in making this, that for all of that closed view of reality, we live in a world in which people are haunted, as it were, by the ghosts of transcendence, as he puts it. Experiences and questions and things that don't really fit a godless universe. And he talks about things like joy, hope, beauty, meaning, truth, love, you know, free will, justice, ethics, the list goes on. And these can be incredibly fruitful areas for starting conversations that can become gospel orientated. You know, I've got a friend of mine who teaches at the University of Toronto, very senior faculty member there, and he teaches human physiology. And one of his favorite tricks is in lectures, in medical lectures, he will raise profound philosophical and theological questions. He'll say, you know, well, this is an interesting question that this raises. And then he'll pause and say to the 500 students listening to him, he'll say, well, we haven't got time to cover that in this lecture. If any of you are interested, my door is always open. And he says, over the years, just by sowing in these kind of questions about these topics across the years, he's found a steady stream of students after lectures coming and knocking on his door and intrigued by some particular question he's thrown into his lecture. And Chris says his response is always then to say, come on in, pull up a chair, the marking can wait, the coffee's on, and he'll sit down and engage with them and show how the Christian faith has the best answers to the question that he's raised. And over the years, he's had the privilege of leading dozens of students to Christ there in his office just by planting the seed in the lecture and then using it to start a conversation. And funnily enough, at Solas over the years, the form of evangelism that we partner with with churches around the country here in the UK is we put on events in coffee shops and pubs and restaurants where we'll take, you know, one of those kind of big kind of questions and approach it in that kind of way, a kind of have you ever wondered way, and explore it together there, you know, often over food and in an environment that's outside the church. And we find that if we do that, and then have a time for very honest questions afterwards, we've seen God work in amazing ways because people are asking searching questions. They just haven't connected those questions to the fact that the Christian faith is a place to go for answers. Well, as we wrap this up, you know, we live in a time when there's incredible opportunities for evangelism right now and in our age, where I think people are asking big questions, and particularly in the workplace, but in other kind of places. And I think certainly coronavirus has raised all kinds of questions, actually. And I think one of the questions that I'm finding, I don't know how this is working in your context, is that coronavirus, I think, has stripped away so many of the certainties that people have been used to about regular work and friends and and life set up the way they were used to it, that they're not quite sure what comes next and what life looks like if things are shaken up a little bit. And one of the things I love doing, particularly in these cafe events, and we're now doing them online in webinars, is sort of challenge people to perhaps think about the fact that maybe the places we have tended as human beings very often to look for meaning and purpose and significance don't actually give us the answers that we're looking for. And I'm finding actually now it's easier to raise those questions than perhaps in the past. I'll leave you with a story to show you how that can work. But, about a year or so ago, I was doing an event at a cafe down in the south of England, and it was a men's event, and lots of the men folk in the church had invited friends to this cafe. We had about 70 or 80 people there. Half the audience were non-Christians, and I was speaking on the topic, the pursuit of happiness. And before the event even started, I was chatting to the audience and got talking to a man in the front row, and I said, "Why did you come today?" And he said, "Well, my Christian colleague at work invited me to come." And he said, "The topic hugely intrigued me." "Oh, why did it intrigue you?" I said. He said, "Well, here's the thing." He said, "For the last 8 years," he said, "I've been working two jobs, working every hour that God sends, which was a great thing to hear as an evangelist, the word God in the conversation already. And he said, "The reason I was working two jobs was I wanted to pay the mortgage off early. My dream was to pay my mortgage off early. I thought it was the best gift I could give to my family and do for my wife and my kids. So I did it. I worked every hour and I earned and I earned and I saved and I saved." And he said, "You know what? Last month I achieved my dream. I paid the mortgage off 9 years early." And he said, "I went into the bank to fill out the paperwork to write the final check. I thought this would be the happiest day of my life." He said, "But as I walked out of that bank," he said, "it was the most miserable day of my life. I felt totally, totally empty, because now the question arose, what am I supposed to do now? Because now that dream is over. I've got nothing to fill that void with." And then he ended his statement with that quote on the slide there. He said, "What happens if you just spend your life climbing the ladder only to discover it's leaning against the wrong building?" He said, "That's why I've come to the talk, so you darn well better answer the question." You see, the gospel, and only the gospel, you know, I do believe answers the questions, the deepest questions our colleagues, our friends and neighbors are asking about purpose, about meaning and justice and hope and significance and all of these things. And my prayer for each one of you is that you would, by the power of the Spirit, have the boldness to ask really good questions, to start great conversations. And then as you teach and train others, for those of us who are teachers and trainers, teach other people to do this, because asking questions is a tool that anybody, whether you've been a Christian for 6 days or 60 years, can use. And as we ask questions and start those conversations, that we would point people towards the one, Jesus, the one who said, "I have come that they might have life and have it to the full." Thanks for listening.